According to the Institute on Disability, if people with disabilities were a formally recognized minority group at 19% of the population, they would be the largest minority group in the United States. Well, what does 19% actually look like? Well, it's over 50 million people, and that has a huge impact on living in the United States. It also has a huge impact on living and learning on our campuses. This week's show features an expert on engaging and serving the disability community. Emily Borde is the founder and CEO of Into Strategies, a disability-led inclusion consultancy committed to bringing people with disabilities into spaces that have not always been as seemingly available or welcoming. Emily brings both the lived experience and strategic eye to the work, and that puts her way out ahead of the pack when it comes to getting results. She's served students with disabilities as the Associate Director of the University of Notre Dame's Sarah B. Center for Students with Disabilities, and went on to work in the Biden-Harris White House as a presidentially appointed Associate Director in the White House Office of Public Engagement, where she did everything from prep the second gentleman to attend the Tokyo Paralympic Games to convening a disabled voting rights activist roundtable with the vice president. In this episode, Emily and I talk about the opportunities in broadening how we consider disability services and what campuses can do to perform audits of their spaces, programs, and academic initiatives in order to make campuses most inclusive. I think you'll figure out pretty quickly why I'm a big fan of Emily's. Enjoy. So, Emily, I have a very serious question for you. You've worked at the White House and you've worked in higher education.
Mm-hmm.
My real question is, what moves slower, federal government or the academy?
All I'll say is both involve very good people trying to do very good work.
Wow.
And both having bureaucracy work against them.
So yeah.
Neither moves very quickly.
No.
Sure.
and your initials, the start of your answer is very politics. So I'll give you that as well. You're very good at this. So
I know. Thank you. The text.
I'm getting my bumper sticker with your name on. Whatever year you want, just let me know what year, and I'll get the bumper sticker made.
There we go.
So Emily, thank you for joining us. And I wanted to talk to you because you do tell us a little bit about kind of your consulting business and what you're doing, because I think that helps frame some of the questions I have for you, especially around the issues around accessibility and disability on our college campuses. So tell us a little bit more about your consulting.
Yeah, so I'm the founder and CEO of Into Strategies, which is a disabled-led consultancy that seeks to bring people with disabilities into spaces. We call it movements, and campaigns, but that can be anything from a physical space to a cultural event to a campaign rally, to a book tour, to a music festival, whatever it may be, bringing people with disabilities in. And the underpinnings for that really lie in my own personal experience as a person with a disability. I was born with a physical disability and use a wheelchair. And I, in coming up through school and in my small town in Indiana, and then I was a classroom teacher. I worked in politics, as you mentioned. I worked in campaigns, I worked in higher ed, I worked in the government, and each and every single one of those spaces, again, people, by and large, I've had the opportunity to work with really incredible people, the people for whom accessibility in the language of disability isn't natural, and spaces that I unfortunately found myself feeling excluded, in spaces that I know my peers with physical disabilities and other disabilities were excluded from. And so my theory of change into strategies is not everyone needs to be an expert on disability, but we all collectively need to be making a commitment to inclusion and accessibility. So bring us on, bring Into Strategies on to build capacity within your team, your organization, and through trainings and workshops, and then also bring us in to help you do a landscape analysis and audit of what you could be doing better in terms of access and inclusion. And then even a step further, if you'd like, let us help you institute that change in those policies. So everything again, from analysis of physical spaces to organizations that have come to us and that have said, we want to put on this conference. We want it to be inclusive, but we don't even know where to begin. Right. And so it necessitates a certain level of vulnerability and a willingness to admit that you don't know what you don't know. But there's great power in that and great leadership in that. And we are always thrilled to work, you know, with organizations, big and small, to create spaces that are better and stronger, knowing that people with disabilities are, you've heard me talk about this before, but people with disabilities are voters, they're donors, they're students, they're volunteers, they're labor workforce, they're X, Y, and Z. And being inclusive of us is competitive advantage. You want us to be in your space because we will only serve to make it that much more rich.
And just folks with disabilities is the largest minority group, correct?
Yeah.
And why don't you think that is something that we're more conscious of? I just don't think we're that conscious of that reality.
Not at all. No. So I often say when people think of a person with a disability, ironically, they often think of somebody that looks like me, somebody that is very, you can't see it in the frame here as we're on Zoom, somebody that is very visibly, unequivocally disabled. I use a wheelchair day to day. And sure, people with physical disabilities, people with very visible disabilities are part of this community, but it is so much more, disproportionately so much more. What encompasses everything from mental health disabilities, anxiety, depression, learning disabilities, with hearing disabilities and vision disabilities, people with spinal cord injuries, people with digestive disabilities, people with cancer, people with bipolar,
everywhere.
The list goes on and on. And whether or not disability self-identification is very personal, you can have the diagnosis, but might not be ready then, or maybe even ever, to self-identify as disabled or as a person with a disability. But that diagnosis in and of itself puts you amongst the community, again, as you said, the largest minority group in the country, and one that is uniquely intersectional with every other identity group in the country, whether that be race, religion, socioeconomic status, age, geography. So all just to say, disability is ubiquitous. It is everywhere. And thus, barriers to access are everywhere. And doing what we can to normalize disability. And on the flip side of that coin, say, okay, now that we are aware that it exists, what do we need to be doing to remove some of those barriers to participation?
Right. I think higher ed, as you obviously went to your undergraduate institution, and your graduate institution was University of Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. And you worked in a higher ed environment. You worked actually at Notre Dame in the disability area. Higher ed, especially in the student affairs landscape, we always talk about how we strive for inclusion. And there is a certain amount of it that what we try to do in student affairs is try to build a sense of affinity that students have towards their institution. We want them to graduate and feel good about spending the time and the money. I'm not going to ignore the money, is that we want them to feel right about it. I want to really kind of focus on the fact that we talk about inclusion a lot. We make that part of our mission. We talk about it as part of our goals and our vision statements. I teach a class in strategic planning, and when I go, I ask them, okay, find mission, vision, and values at the institution. And a lot of it's kind of this word salad, where we throw out the same words, but do we actually see it in practice? What do you think, as you're considering this idea of like inclusivity and in terms of the mission that institutions have, what are they not getting quite right when it comes to inclusion of our folks who might be in that disability space? Do they think too much about physical space? I think sometimes we think a lot about physical. We don't think about what inclusion is when you have an invisible disability. And how does that look? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I think the block is twofold. I think one, it oftentimes just a reticent to even use the language of disability, as is the case in conversations about race and religion. If people aren't familiar with the language, they sometimes opt out because they don't want to offend or they don't want to say the wrong thing. And so I find myself often in conversations about inclusion, again, really well-intentioned people. It's not that they're trying to sell snake oil, well-intentioned people, but they just are kind of tiptoeing around what inclusion operationally looks like,
right,
for people with disabilities. And even an admittance that there aren't people with disabilities occupying the space in the first place. And secondarily, I think access and inclusion is for people with disabilities, the work that I do, it's to a certain extent technical. I'm a subject matter expert because I have lived with my disability. It's a lived experience that I've had for 31 years. And in aspects of access and inclusion in which I am not personally experiencing day in and day out, I've taken the time to learn, to study what does access look like for somebody who is deaf? What does access look like for somebody who has a learning disability?
Mm-hmm.
As somebody that does not have that lived experience or who has not taken the time to kind of study the technicality, again, you can say that you want to be inclusive and be really well-intentioned, but you might just not know what that looks like in practice.
Mm.
You might not know that, you might be designing a space and think, okay, we've done a really good job. We've made this space inclusive. We have an accessible restroom. We have a sign on the door that says accessible. We have entry. We've checked all these boxes, but that accessible restroom you have might not have a power automatic door, or that conference you think is going to be accessible. Maybe the podium isn't of adjustable height. You have somebody who is of small stature, or somebody in a wheelchair that isn't able to use it. And I say this not as a gotcha moment, right? I'm never trying to call people out and say, well, you got there 90% of the way, but not 100%. But I think my previous point, committing to inclusivity and actually putting it into practice necessitates a learning and a vulnerability and saying, I don't know exactly what this looks like. Help me out.
Yeah.
And it's okay, right? I wouldn't expect somebody to know what true access looks like for someone who is deaf, or true access looks like for somebody that's in a wheelchair if they have not experienced it themselves. So, and you don't need to be planning for every contingency, but you need to enter with a mindset that says, I am here to learn and I'm here to do my best to not just, run through a checklist, but to really think in a kind of a backwards mapping sort of way what it would look like in practice to create spaces that are inclusive.
Yeah, I appreciate what you're saying, and especially around this idea of vulnerability and this, I mean, frankly, check yourself. You're not an expert on everything. And we're only, when you are able to connect with subject matter experts and people who may have a lived experience in a space, and what I've found in many cases, it doesn't have to be in the disability space. It can be in many, I mean, frankly, that's how I get guests for the show, right? I find experts who are like, yeah, I'll talk to you for an hour, and I don't offer them anything other than, hey, thanks. I mean, it's they do come through because they have an expertise to share. And I've found this specific to the disability space when I was challenged by some of the guidance around Title IX at the time, mm-hmm. around sexual assault, sexual violence. We had students on the campus where I worked who were going through the investigatory process because of an action that they had. It ends up that the student was neurodivergent. And I said, okay, we need to kind of look at this. Okay. And so I called up someone who had an expert. I literally went out on LinkedIn and I'm like, I think your wife is associated with an organ. Yes, it is. So I'm like, go on to LinkedIn, find my friend, said, can I talk to your wife?
Absolutely.
And he said, and I said, right. And you got to, and I had her talk to our Title IX people and be like, okay, where do we have this here in the spirit of what is Title IX in the investigation process? We have a situation where the student, because of their neurodivergent status, that there are some aspects here that we have to be mindful of in this investigation and how we handle it, but also what informs the policy and that sort of thing. So I appreciate that, in that even people who are living with a disability, that they have some vulnerability and say, I know I'm an expert in my own, but I'm not an expert in somebody else's, and how that happens. The other thing that got me thinking about all of this in terms of inclusivity has to do with families and the first impression people have of our campuses. I'm in a situation now. My daughter is a junior in high school, so now we're ramping up on just going and visiting campuses. And I will tell you, most campuses that we have visited so far don't even ask, like, in bold, do you require anything for, does anyone in your party require handicapped accessibility? Do we have any issues that we need here that we need to address? And then the other thing that I found is that we were even on one tour on a campus and a young person needed a motorized wheelchair, got mm-hmm. around in a motorized wheelchair, and just, it should not have been a surprise what this human needed to get around and get and participate, and it just didn't happen. That just crushed me. Like, I and part of the problem with me going on these tours, frankly, Emily, is like, I feel like a secret shopper. I don't want to go in and go, hi, I've been working in this field for 30 years and I'm going to evaluate everything you're doing. But in the back of my mind, I'm like, so I think we also have to start thinking about not only the life once the student gets here, but the first impression of how they engage with the campus.
Totally.
And that comes from when you're doing an assessment of a campus, if someone were to bring you there and say, tell me what we need to do better, would you be looking at just what they're asking you about? Or would you be thinking about these broader aspects of how students and their families are even initiating their conversations or their relationship with the campus? Or when you're asked to come in, and people go, I know I need an evaluation. I know someone needs to look at this.
Yeah.
Do you find that often that people aren't even asking the right questions when they're doing that? What do you think?
Absolutely. So to start up the ladder, yes, people generally don't know what questions even ask, which is okay, right? Like you don't know what you don't know about, again, this topic that is both in a lot of ways sensitive and very personal. So I always stop people and just say, well, let us provide you with information and then you can follow up questions from there, right? Like, you don't have to come in and ask the exact right question to get the answer you're looking for. And then secondarily, absolutely. So I'm looking for compliance and I'm looking for experience moving through spaces, but I'm also looking for culture, which feels a little squishy. And I know some might kind of roll their eyes at, but people that are interacting with visitors to a campus or prospective students to a campus need to similarly be prepared with appropriate language to use. And again, they don't need to know every contingency. They don't need to know what to do if X, Y, Z, P, D, Q, every discipline kind of, but they need to know the appropriate language to use when asking if somebody could utilize an accommodation or if they could utilize assistance. And two, they need to know who to call if they have a question. So for example, in your instance with this visitor needing a scooter, that student tour guide or that tour guide needs to feel confident to say, how can I help? What's going to be best in this situation? Not try to just like shy away or pretend it's not happening. And then two, they need to know, okay, do we need to call services? Do we need to call the visitor center? Who has that? It's going to have that power to, right? So yes, definitely thinking about kind of the culture in which you're entering as well. So, and I want to go roll back for just a second. You mentioned in signing up for these campus visits or in these tours, best practice, absolutely, if you are welcoming visitors onto your campus or into your space, is to have a text box, a required field. I always tell people it'd be a required field that says, do you have any accommodations that would make this visit more accessible to you? And if somebody doesn't, then they could just put in here, they say, no, I'm good. But it proactively provides an opportunity for, say, me, a visitor in a chair, to say, I'm a wheelchair user, so my tour or my visit is going to need stair-free access and an accessible restroom along the tour. That onus then is not placed on the person with the disability to go right. to some fine print email at the bottom of a page that might not go anywhere. And mm-hmm. it's empowering to the university, to the campus, to the visitor center, because now they have the information. Again, they don't need to just sit and cross their fingers that they don't have anybody in a chair that's going to be on this, right. this tour. They have information in advance that says, okay, we can be prepared, we can be knowledgeable, and make tweaks if we need to. I'll give you just a short example. So I, for a while, was thinking about going to law school, and too much school. I decided not need any more school. But for a while, I was thinking about it, and I had actually taken the LSAT, and I had applied, and I had been admitted to a few schools and was going just for a handful of like admitted student days on mm-hmm. campuses, and visited a campus, and they had a great program during the day. And then they said, at the end of the day, we invite you to this local restaurant, and we'll have a student reception, and there'll be or a prospective student reception, and there'll be current students, and there'll be faculty, and we look forward to continuing to get to know you. And I got to this reception, and it was upstairs at this bar restaurant. And I approached one of the staff, and they said, and I was like, hey, was there an elevator to get upstairs? Always just right. hoping, best hoping that, for goodness sakes, please, they thought about this. They had not. there was no elevator. And so they were kind of scrambling. You could tell them. They were like, well, we could send a professor down to sit with you downstairs. And I was like, that's okay. It hadn't been the best visit anyway, but yeah, yeah. that was the kind of final straw that it was like, no, I'd rather not. So that's like a really undignified experience to have. And all that it would have taken mm-hmm. was one of two things, or two things in tandem: an opportunity for me to have indicated up front that I was a chair user, and two, somebody thinking proactively about what access could and should look like. And that it was just a huge missed opportunity. And yeah, again, you never want to leave, whether they be prospective students or visitors or donors, to feel like they have been like so significantly othered.
Right.
When taking proactive steps wouldn't have carried a price tag, wouldn't have been that much more. Right. By any means.
Well, and it's about standard operating procedures, right? That you say, okay, these are the things we need to do from an efficiency standpoint. These are the things that we have to do. Turn on the heat, do this, do that. Like, there's all these things we have to do.
Totally.
But you have to have this, like, this space where you say, okay, here's the services space. What are the things that we have to provide? What are the things we have to check off mm-hmm. on? I, in one of my various roles on various campuses, I used to do commencement. And commencement, anyone who runs a commencement goes straight to heaven. Like, that's all I have to say, because it is just, there's no one's happy. Like,
yeah, you can't happy. Everyone is.
Oh my God. It's like, you got to do everything perfect, and you have to anticipate everything and all that. But in all joking aside, it truly was one of my more joyous aspects of my job.
Mm-hmm.
But the space of the when you had handicapped seating and space for that, and you needed to have certain sight lines to the ASL interpreter, and you needed to have all of these things. And people would be like, well, isn't it okay if we just, I said, do not even finish the sentence.
Right.
We are being told that this is our best bet. We are also now being told our ASL interpreter is on the short side, so we need to get a taller box for her to stand on.
Right.
Like, are you kidding me? No, I am not kidding you. I am right now. We need a bigger box. Like,
right.
You always have to have a contingency.
Absolutely.
You always have to be ready to go, and not out of a bother, but out of, okay, you'd never want someone to miss the most important day of their life because you planned wrong.
Absolutely.
And because you didn't provide for that.
Absolutely.
And even I used to always put out there, walk the campus, go the route that everyone's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't only about folks who might be needing, whether it be a wheelchair, a walker, a scooter, or whatever the case may be. Frankly, I've worked on some old ass campuses where things will. Notre Dame's old. Like, there's places I've worked. I'm like, yeah, there's a hole in the ground now that wasn't there yesterday. We can't go that way. We might lose somebody. Like, we have to make sure that you're doing these things. So before you do anything, walk the campus, whether it be, I used to joke with the vice president for advancement and the vice president for enrollment services, because like, make sure there's no beer bottles around. I'm like, oh, God forbid there's no beer bottles around, but let's make sure that everybody can get around. So as we're thinking about that access, and we're thinking about what does that inclusivity space look like and feel like, I think a big thing that I'm picking up from you is that the institution may just be missing the parts that they almost have a blinder on.
Absolutely.
They go, okay, we've been told we need this and this. Well, there's people who don't tell you, or there's also temporary disabilities, which we haven't talked about. So a kid who signs up for a tour a month ago may have broken their leg in a football game that week. Showing up on campus, you need to be ready to rock and roll regardless.
Yep. You know what I always say is your best bet is to just design universally from the start.
Right.
So if your tour route, if your standard prospective student tour route takes you down a flight of stairs and through the woods and around the river, it's not a good tour route.
Like, no.
You know what I mean? Not. Like, what if we just started from the top and designed it? Everybody goes on the elevator, not just,
right.
just a break off for one person that needs to take the elevator. What if we just all go on the elevator? What if we all go through the accessible entrance? What if we take the route that isn't up and down a million flights of stairs?
Right.
That eliminates a lot of the stress for everybody involved, because these student tour guides or these staff tour guides don't need to be thinking of alternative routes, contingencies. Mm-hmm. And you're totally in the instance that somebody hasn't submitted their request for accommodations or situations have changed, they don't have to be concerned that they're going to be excluded or get to this moment where they're going to need to hold back or fall back or whatever it means. Right. So,
well, and I think that as you talk about universal design, every aspect of the work that we do on a campus should be put through that lens. Mm-hmm. And how many campuses have maybe changed a process and not realized that by changing a process, this upends somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We, at one point in my career, we changed to what was a physical room selections process where you had to go to a space, you had to pick a room, you had to talk to somebody and put it on a piece of paper, which was a lot of work and very tense and frankly crazy, to the best practice, which was go to an online process.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked to people on campus as we were rolling out this process, and somebody in our disability services office said, I'm just going to throw this out there. This can be very overwhelming for students with these types of disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
Can you have something arranged for any student? Any student could use it, but have a space. And so we ended up setting up in our office a couple of people who had the computers there. If you didn't want to do it yourself, you could come to the office and you could have them go over it with you and walk you through it and do the process with you. And excuse me, it was one of those things that we felt that it was the right thing to do at the time. The number of students who took us up on the offer was very low, but when it was there and we had students come through and say, you know what, I'm glad that it made everything better. And overall, it actually made a more universal experience. Yep. Some of the students who came to see us wasn't because they needed it because of an accommodation. Their internet's crapping out, or their computer is just an old computer and this system is more than the computer can handle. Whatever the case may be, you need to be ready for it. And I think that idea of inclusivity and universal design go hand in hand. And that we need to be thinking about that in terms of when we consider what an inclusive campus looks like. I want to ask you about that campus life aspect. And I think sometimes we look at campus life and we think of when you see pictures on websites or you see things on and now on social media, Instagram, et cetera, it's a very ableist kind of world. And what I've seen from the student affairs area is that we make it the default mechanism that people have to ask if they need something rather than just plan for it, which we've kind of talked about. But in addition to that, kind of change up your process, are there ways that campuses can kind of knock away that ableist campus life? And what are some of the warning signs that you have an ableist campus life?
Oh, that's a great question. Something I think a lot about and I see happening at a lot of schools is they put a lot of resources towards the accommodation process, to standing up a really strong, compliant accommodation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they don't necessarily put adequate resources to creating like inclusive culture. So what do I mean by that? So the accommodations process, again, legally required, legal protection that students are able to request accommodations. I worked in the accommodations process when I was at Notre Dame and have sought accommodations. So I've seen kind of both sides of it. And the accommodations process is phenomenal and is necessary and provides access for students to education. But for anybody that has been in it, been through it or worked in it, it's very clunky. It's pretty administrative. That necessitates paperwork from a physician or a clinician. It necessitates students first reaching out to request accommodations. There's got to be conversations involved. So it's all to say it's kind of bureaucratic.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
It is. At some schools more than others, unfortunately. But it's like, okay, you've been approved. You get this thing, this, here's this. And like, we washed our hands. We're good to go. What I don't see as often, which is so important, is training not only of student affairs staff, but of faculty, hall staff, of dining hall workers, of advisors, of maintenance staff, anybody that's going to be interacting with students. This is what not only those accommodations look like in practice, but this is how to interact with and be inclusive of students with disabilities. If the professor is just getting a list from student affairs, the disability services office, these are the students in my class that have a accommodation, great, there and done. That's one thing, but that professor actually reaching out to that student and saying, what can I do to support? Or hall staff or rectors reaching out to that student and saying, what can I do to support, is so absolutely critical. I think another sign that your campus is falling into ableism is as new infrastructure is built or as retrofit, it continuing to not be accessible.
Right.
I mean that, unfortunately, some at Notre Dame, but at other campuses as well, we saw a lot of makeshift infrastructure that popped up during the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so frustrating to see all these resources being poured in and it's still not accessible.
Right.
And so doing what you can to invest early and often in not trying to tack on accessibility down the road.
Yep. You brought up that whole idea of the spending the resource money in a space. And it got me thinking, and this might be a Emily who worked for the federal government question more than anything. We would always see when you had to do deferred maintenance or improvements to building, we could get some money from the state or from whatever agency to improve our energy footprint.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We don't get a lot, maybe I'm wrong, but are you aware of grants that say, hey, because I mean, I'm in New England and Paul Revere built these things. These are not new construction. And when you have to put a new door on a building with a door opener, that is and it was literally, I've been in places. I remember one of the buildings that I was in, it has one of these like oval doorways. So like the door is beautiful. You're like, we don't want to remove that door. Like, what do we do? I wish there was some kind of grant program that said, do you want to keep your campus with the character that was there, but make sure that it is meeting these accessibility standards? why don't you go through this? You know what I mean? Like, I wish there was something out there. If there is, let us know and I'll put it in the show notes. But yeah. Like, I wish there was more of that.
Yeah, there is very little. There are some tax incentives, I think very few, and they are very minimal as compared to the price that some of these larger infrastructure alterations can cost. So those are good, but I always say, I think of like small businesses or folks who have less capital up front, they're still needing to put those resources.
It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. Like, it's just replacing certain things costs a tremendous amount. And we all know it. I mean, we all see it in our everyday lives and what we have to do for our own families and for ourselves. Imagine making that a bigger investment in terms of an office building or a campus or something of that nature. I want to ask. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. My pushback to that a little bit, though, would be I always try to make a distinction between small businesses, certainly homes, and colleges and universities that have large budgets that are saying we have the money, but in their reality, they're just not prioritizing.
Correct. Correct.
Right. Yes, so there's some gray area.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think part of the reason I brought it up is, and I absolutely value what you're saying. The reason I brought it up is we've all had something where we've had to pay for something out of our own pocket and because it's necessary and we've prioritized it. But now if you look at it, you say, okay, well, we know that's not free because I had to pay for it. Right. So you know what the cost is, but you do have to prioritize it, to your point. Sure. Like, if I've got my grandmother moving in and now she's using a wheelchair, I've got to change how my house is in order for grandma to feel welcome in the house. That's a priority. The campus needs to put the same priorities there. It is absolutely an important piece. And I think that idea of that ableist, I want to just kind of wrap up on that before I get to the next question. But I think there's also that ableist environment because I've seen it too many times on too many of the campus I've worked on, and then people who have reported to me what they've seen on either their own campus or because their child's gone off to school, is that, oh, we have a place for you to have that accommodation, whether it be your dorm room, whether it be the classroom that you need, et cetera. But it's not where everyone else is.
Yes. Yes.
And that's just terrible.
Yes. Absolutely. I'm so glad that you bring that up. Yes, there are. And this kind of goes back to my point, right, about some colleges and universities, they have their accommodations process tight and they say, okay, we're good. We've checked the box. But if you are creating a system in which students with disabilities are getting separate but equal, or maybe even separate but unequal, that is not an equitable system. Mm-hmm. They don't have the peer effects of their classmates, their peers. And that is something that they're paying for and now something that they're missing out on. Yeah. So I know when I was looking at schools initially, there were a number of schools I visited where the accessible dorm rooms, were all actually in one single dorm building.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like, this is where students with disabilities live. And that was really off-putting for me at the schools that I visited. Not because I wouldn't want to be, it was exciting to think that there were going to be enough other kids in chairs or students in chairs, that there would be enough for us to be in the dorm. But the thought of being in this kind of almost segregated experience, student experience, that's not equity. That's not kind of mainstreamed, which is something that students all should have the right to and access to. And that's, and maybe we'll get to this, but that's, we've been talking so much about like physical disabilities and physical space, and that's such a big part of it. But I also do want to talk about, you know, mental health disabilities, learning disabilities, physical disabilities, as you mentioned. Like, this is so much more far reaching than just how we're physically designing spaces.
And it also has to do with the activities we're providing. And what we're doing is on one of my campuses where we had a pretty large population of students who were neurodivergent. Mm-hmm. And when I say large, I mean, like, it was notable because I think some of the majors we had were attractive to the population. We had a game design program. So you're making video games. It was a very popular program for them. We had a veterinary technology program. students who liked being around animals more than they liked being around people. There were certain aspects. Mm-hmm. And we had several students come to us and say, we'd like to have a game night on a Friday night. And I'm like, sure. And so the people in our student activities office and the student center helped them get it all set up. And you're like, when you ever start something, you're always like, how many people are going to show up? How many people? Even though it doesn't matter.
Sure, right.
Like, but how many people are going to show up? Place was banged out. And there was a certain population that was part of the problem. Like, so if they were doing board games, it was a little more interactive. Whereas we had students doing video games on another part of the building, and they all had big headphones on, and there were those, and it was really social, but not verbal at all. And it was one of those things where people walk in and they're like, I don't feel like I understand what's happening. I'm like, you don't need to. This mm-hmm. isn't about you. This yeah, is sure. about making sure that the students here feel like they belong in
Everyone
their space.
Has
Absolutely. Yep. And that's the thing. I think sometimes our campus traditions, and you went to undergrad and graduate school at one of the most traditions-oriented universities in America.
Yeah.
Some of these traditions don't speak to inclusion at all.
Totally.
And if I'm somebody who's not good with noise, if I'm someone who needs to, I get social anxiety, it's just too much. We do this through our orientation programs. We're like, we're going to have everybody go through and talk about, but I'm like, why? Yeah. Why are we having people have to get up and talk in front
Absolutely.
Of people? I mean, let's really back off. And some of the pandemic has helped in that regard, because what I hear from people is folks were not used to being in crowds. And so they're not really there in terms of that aspect of their development. I'm like, but actually, this is actually better overall. From a universal design, I think this is more inclusive and that sort of thing. And I think that there is an element of that inclusivity and that aspect of, again, we always defer, as you said, to checking off boxes. I'm like, can we stop with the checking off boxes and ask the first question, which is, how do we want our students to feel?
Absolutely. 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 A good example of this, as you're talking about social anxiety and students who don't fit into what a lot of these campuses kind of build a mold, and they think that all students fit into this mold.
Right.
We haven't even dipped our toe into instruction or into the classroom experience. No. But one thing that comes to mind is how many professors change a small, if not large, part of one's grade on participation.
Mm-hmm.
And that in and of itself, the intent behind it is they want students to be engaged.
Yeah.
But they see that engagement as taking one form. And it mm-hmm. is speaking
it is
in front
different.
Of their classmates. And being in person in a classroom, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because even if a hybrid option is available, it's very infrequent that students who are joining virtually are able to participate.
Right.
And so we have to pause and ask ourselves, like, why are we, why just because of this student's mm-hmm. identity as someone who has a mm-hmm. disability, mm-hmm. are we preventing them from getting full?
Right.
They could have had an A in the class, but not have been able clinically to participate.
Right.
So they're getting docked for that. Right.
Well, from an instructional standpoint, I'm going to give myself a tap on the back here, because I changed the language in my own syllabus to class engagement, not class participation, that right. in itself. And then I said, okay, it is made up of these various things, whether it be participating in class, active participation in class, whether I have a certain amount of discussion boards, I have a certain amount of this, and you can also credit for this by coming to my office hours and talking to me about class. Right. And so there's a bunch here that says you can tell if a student is engaged in your class.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Especially when you give them many options that will fit into whether it be about their accommodation need, personality, how they learn, it goes into all of that. And you actually create a better environment. Sure. My big beef with classroom stuff, before we get to, because we're going to run out of time, but I want to say this. My big beef when it comes to instruction is around instructional design right now and things like Blackboard, Canvas, Moodle.
Absolutely.
None of them are ADA compliant.
Absolutely not. No.
None of them.
I know universities who have known that going in and who have still opted.
Yeah.
You know, like in their comparative analysis as they're looking to procure a product. They have known that it is not compliant, but they have said, but this is our best option. Mm-hmm. And dude, that's not any better than building a building that only has stared accents, like
right,
explicitly excluding a group of students from full educational experience, and then putting the onus on those students and, frankly, the faculty to navigate alternatives.
Right.
And none of them do. I don't know of any that are fully.
No, I mean, if there is, please, someone tag me on social. But right now, my understanding is no. Last year, when I had a student last year who needed hearing assistance in terms of the classroom, mm-hmm. as well as other things. And I had an activity within our Canvas system where it was supposed to be a video or audible or auditory or whatever, audio file, excuse me. Response, like, so Emily puts in one, then I pop one in and blah, blah, blah. Well, that mm-hmm. didn't work because it didn't yeah. have captioning and yeah. it just didn't have it in the thing. And I was like, okay, got to take that out. No more. We can't do this, da, 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 and all this. And she kind of muscled through some stuff. And I'm like, no, I don't like you muscling through. What are we going to do? And sure. and all that. But I said to the folks in instructional design now, I said, we're not doing this anymore. I'm going to sure. use just straight up text, but we need to do better. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where higher ed can actually work within spaces and say, hey, vendors, we love you. We understand what you're trying to do. But when are we going to get off of our butts and actually make something happen here? Because it actually makes for a better universal experience. Mm-hmm. I remember the very first time I saw a device that looked, now I think about it, it looked not like a BlackBerry, but remember those phones that kind of flipped up? They're in two, you know, those
Sidekick.
Yes, a Sidekick. It looked like a Sidekick. Yeah. And it looked like a Sidekick, like an early version of it. And my office at one point was literally adjacent to the disability services office at the university. So I was residence life. They were disability services. And the person whose office was right next to mine ran the ASL interpreter program.
Okay.
And he came in my office, he goes, look at this. And he shows me. And I said, that's cool. And he's like, I can use this to communicate with my students and all the stuff. Now we all have it. Now we all have it. And that's the thing. When I think about why Canvas can't fix or Blackboard can't fix, I'm like, we all could have it and it could help all of us.
Okay. Absolutely.
So, all right.
So like it's, I know we're getting on all kinds of tangents, but universities has a lot of sway. I mean, I don't know where to begin.
Yes, we do.
Or like how to guess how much some of these subscriptions to these platforms.
Oh God.
These learning management.
Thousands of dollars a day.
Oh yeah. I don't even, but a lot. And a handful of schools like withholding subscriptions or saying, like, how can we work with you to make this more simple? We aren't going to renew our subscription. Right. That is, that isn't a incentive for mm-hmm. some of these tech developers to make their, you know, products more accessible. I don't know what is.
Right. Exactly.
And the money talks. Yeah, exactly. Universities are just saying, well, this is as good as it's going to get. And it's like, no, we don't have to shoot for better. Let's shoot for best. Let's shoot for fully inclusive, not just cobbling together something that's pretty inclusive.
As I like to say, don't half-ass it, full-ass it.
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. Let's do that. I want to give you one last kind of moment at the microphone. We've talked about inclusivity. We've talked about class. We've touched on classroom. We talked about culture. Is there something else that you're like, no, there's one more thing I don't want to stop talking without saying? Campuses need to do a better job with blank.
I think, like I said, we talk so much about physical accessibility. When I enter a space, when I arrived on Notre Dame's campus, nobody questions that I was disabled or that I was in accommodations.
Right.
Colleges and universities need to be doing better at offering accommodations and creating inclusive culture, inclusive spaces for people with invisible disabilities. That can be anything from mental health diagnosis to eating disorders to Crohn's disease, right? Even students for whom the accommodations process it's foreign, right? Mm-hmm. When I was working in student affairs, disability services, I had so many students that came to me and they said, somebody recommended I come here. I don't even know if I qualify. And I would say, oh my gosh, tell your friend, yes, you qualify. Let's dig in. But 99% of the time, they had a diagnosis, but disability wasn't them. And so they didn't come to the disability services office. Disability was their peer that used a wheelchair or their peer that was very visibly disabled, but it wasn't them. So campuses need to be doing a better job of proactively reaching out to students, availing themselves to students through the formal accommodations process and through just the culture of inclusivity that they're creating on campuses. Your non-traditional, invisibly disabled students, because many of those students aren't aware that resources available, and many of those students' disabilities prevent them from being able to make the first move in reaching out to the process. So if you have depression, if you have OCD, if you have a disability that prevents you from reading the website of the disability services office because it's not web compliant, those are the students that we need to be reaching out to. And that doesn't fall on just the disability services office, right? That's why we need to be training our faculty, our staff, our administrative support staffs, our advisors, our all staff, whatever it may be, just to be looking at the world, at the context, at their students through this lens. And so that doesn't put all the work on just one group. It doesn't put the work on the students or the faculty at the disability services office, but it creates this robust culture in which we're all looking out for each other and we're all looking out for that student who might otherwise slip through the cracks, but that needs support, that needs accommodations, or just pointed in the right direction for non-formal accommodation resources.
Emily, that's a perfect way to end. So thank you so much. And hey, you're loved.
We all
need our soapbox. And I want to just say it one more time. We've been bringing in experts over the course of this season. Just, it wasn't by design. It just was kind of how it happened. But that, get an audit. Bring in an expert to do an audit.
I promise I'm not here to publish that audit to the New York Times.
No.
Like, let it be a tool that you use internally as you create your 5-year plan, 10-year plan. Commit to at least becoming aware of the ways in which you can improve. Mm-hmm. And I promise you, the return on that investment will be tenfold as you create inclusive spaces of belonging for your students, for prospective students, for donors.
Yep.
Accessibility looks good.
Feels good.
And it feels good, right? It's the right thing to do. So yes, bring on folks like Intu to help you, and to, again, not leave you to feel bad about yourselves that you're falling short, but instead empower you to make small incremental change and then to set those longer term goals down the road.
Thank you, Emily, for all you do.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, Laura. Be well.
Thank you. Well, something that happened since taping this episode, just to show you what a great person Emily is and how hard she works. Emily worked with the White House and the U.S. Department of Transportation, and as a result, they created what may be considered the most sweeping advances in rights for disabled travelers in 30 years. In February, the U.S. Department of Transportation proposed the Air Carrier Access Act to address what they call, in quotes, serious problems that individuals with disabilities using wheelchairs and scooters face when traveling by air that impact their safety and dignity. As Emily noted in the show, when you fly and you are someone who lives their lives using a wheelchair or a scooter, you have to leave your device behind. And this would mean that over time, that will not be the case. And it will protect those devices, which are very expensive. So, all good stuff. Hope you liked her. pretty cool stuff, right? I couldn't think of a better person to call, frankly, if you are trying to make your campus experience more dignified for members of your disability community. So thank you for being an Office Hours listener. In order to grow our community, please rate, review, and share our podcast with your network. I would so very much appreciate it. And hey, don't forget the show notes, because there you'll be able to find more information on how to reach out to Emily, get her engaged with your campus, perform your audit, and so much more. I would like to thank my wonderful producer, David Yaz. And remember, Office Hours is a production of Pod 617 Studios in Westwood, Massachusetts. Now get out there and learn something.